So this evening I'm going to be giving the second of this series of four talks on the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, the wholesome mental states that the Buddha encouraged us to cultivate repeatedly and throughout the sutta. So tonight we're going to look at karuna, which translates as compassion. I want to define this in two ways. First is the dictionary definition. A feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken by misfortune, accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate the suffering. Which is an interesting thing. Often we think of compassion as just being struck by the suffering, but there's that accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate the suffering. It has a much stronger emphasis on doing something. And there are different views on how compassion arises and where it sits in the Pali Canon and in other traditional Buddhist teachings. But in the Theravada world that I practice and teach in, compassion, which is a wholesome mind state, arises when a mind full of loving kindness encounters suffering. So, loving kindness is the root of the whole of the teaching. Remember, I said last week that the four Brahma Viharas are very interrelated and influence each other, and this is one of the ways. So what does this mean? It means you are mentally putting yourself in the other person's shoes. You know, imagine what it must be like to be in that situation that they're in. And it requires action. It isn't like, okay, I feel sorry for you. But, you know, I don't have any time to do anything about it. But without action, what we have is empathy. Empathy is like feeling the emotional energy of another. Which is fine, that's what empathy is, but compassion has that extra element of, I feel what you're feeling, as best I can, I experience what you're experiencing, the suffering you're going through, the trouble you have, and I want to do something about it, you know, as much as I can, as best I can. I've got several different sources of people talking about it. Obviously, the first person to go to is the Dalai Lama, who is, I don't think he probably goes a day without saying the word compassion 10 times or something. It's just his nature. He says, one of the differences between empathy and compassion is that while empathy is simply experiencing another's emotion, compassion is a more empowered state where we want what is best for the other person. As the Dalai Lama has described it, if we see a person who is being crushed by a rock, the goal is not to get under the rock and feel what they are feeling. It's to help to remove the rock. I like this. It's a really simple image that explains, we don't want to just feel what they're feeling. We don't want to get under the rock with them. We want to move the rock somehow, as best we can, help move the rock. This is from the Book of Joy, by the way, which is a wonderful book of the Dalai Lama's teachings. This is the other thing the Dalai Lama has to say. While everyone agrees that being compassionate is a worthy goal, it is hard for many people to understand or to put into practice. The word compassion, as we have said, literally means suffering with. So what would you say to a person who says, I have enough problems on my own. Why should I worry about being more compassionate and think about others who are suffering? It sounds like a legitimate question, right? See, I mean, and certainly a lot of people would ask that question when we talked about this. And this is the Dalai Lama's response to that question. As we have discussed, we are social animals. Even for kings or queens or spiritual leaders, their survival depends on the rest of the community. So, therefore, if you want a happy life and fewer problems, you have to develop a serious concern for the well-being of others. So when someone is passing through a difficult period or difficult circumstances, then automatically will come a sense of concern for their well-being. And if there's the possibility to help, then you can help. If there's no possibility to help, you can just pray or wish them well. Even that, like that, which is basically saying setting the intention to wish them well and wish that they get out of their situation, at least they somehow get relief from the suffering they're experiencing. Even that's doing something in a small way. And the other thing, it's in terms of compassion, just like with metta, you know, loving kindness, the person we have to, as we're practicing and we start directing our energy towards experiencing compassion more completely, the first person we have to have compassion for is ourselves, before anyone else. Because if we can't feel, just like metta, if we can't feel compassion for ourselves, then it's going to be very difficult to have those feelings for others. And you think, well, but I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I don't need any compassion, right? Well, actually, the truth is we're all suffering. There's no human being who doesn't at some point suffer, and at some degree suffer. It's just part of being a human being. Even if it's like that existential suffering of, well, one day I'm going to die, I'm going to get sick, I'm going to get old, I'm going to die. Even if it's just that, even if everything else is peachy keen. But we all have bodies, we all, you know, have things that don't work so well or break down, or we have relationships, or we have a family, then, and family troubles. There's always some source of trouble in people's lives. It's just part of being human. It's pretty hard to not be, have some difficulty in your life. So, once again, this is from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. I want to read a few things here. The first step in developing true compassion is being able to recognize, to open to, and to acknowledge that pain and sorrow exist. Seems like, well, this is pretty obvious, but it's amazing how often we sort of try and shove those thoughts away as if, well, no, there's lots of thought. The world's just a happy place. You know. Everywhere, absolutely everywhere, in one way or another, beings are suffering. Such suffering is intense and terrible. Some is quiet and small. W. H. Auden wrote, about suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. Just in daily, everyday life. While suffering is not all there is in life, it is a thread that needs to be recognized clearly if we are to develop true compassion. Like, this is what binds us together. This is what makes us all not separate. We all, without exception, live lives where suffering arises. It's part of being a human being. If we look at our own experience, it comes as no big surprise that suffering exists. We have our ups and downs. We have pain or loss or sorrow, times when we do not get what we want, or we do get what we don't want, but it goes away or proves to be not what we wanted after all. We all experience this pattern. Because we know this experience as real, not receiving external confirmation of our perception is actually far more painful than a frank acknowledgement would be. It's like we try and deny this truth. Over and over and over again, we try and deny this truth. We go, no, that's, my life is hunky-dory all the time. It's wonderful. And just don't, as best we can, experience the parts that aren't. We shut them out. We push them away. And that just makes it worse. Yet we are brought up with the feeling that suffering is somehow wrong or to be avoided. This is definitely the cultural norm. You know, that's something wrong. You know, something wrong with you if you're suffering. You should know how to avoid it. You know, be in control. You know? So we create a society that accommodates our need to deny pain as best we can. We use material consumption and painkillers to avoid suffering. We take people who are different, people who are in trouble, people who are old, people who are dying, and put them out of sight in institutions. These are forms of suffering we all share. There is so much humiliation and bitterness about getting sick or growing old or dying that we feel we have to hide our pain. Having done many years of hospice work and now volunteering as a chaplain at the hospital, I see this over and over again where people just can't deal with this, don't want to look at this. Family members, the people, the person themselves. It's like, no, it's not, this isn't happening. This isn't true. Sadly, this is what they think. So this is one thing from Sharon. The other thing I wanted to read, this is a little interesting tidbit, I think. A story from the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, illustrates this human drive to deny. Yudhishthira is asked, what is the most wondrous thing in the entire world? Just think that. Think about that. What is the most wondrous thing in the entire world? He replies, the most wondrous thing in the entire world is that all around us people can be dying and we don't believe it can happen to us. Not me. That's everybody else. That happens to everybody else, but not me. Right? We deny our experience. We are always moving away from something real to something fabricated. To live by this web of legend will always harm us. The truth may be difficult to open to, but it will never hurt us. What a tremendous relief to have actual truth openly spoken. There is suffering in this world. Everything is up front. There are no games, no pretense, no denial. To acknowledge the truth of suffering allows us to feel our unity with others. This is really an important point. The goal of our spiritual practice is to be able to understand, to be able to look without illusion at what is natural in this life, at what is actually happening for others and for ourselves. This willingness to see what is true is the first step in developing compassion. You see, yeah, this is what happens to everyone without exception. It's shocking when that sinks in, but so, why doesn't compassion just naturally arise then, if this is true, if everybody has, you know, deals with it? And basically, it's because of our own unwholesome mental patterns. So instead of compassion, we encounter suffering, and what do? First of all, our usual reaction, if we see someone else suffering, might be to turn away. to avoid the unpleasantness we experience when we encounter someone or some group of beings who is suffering. We see the suffering and we go, oh, don't want that. Don't want to even look at that. Don't want to think about that. I'm supposed to be happy, right? This makes me unhappy. I don't want to be unhappy, so I'm going to not look at it. We don't want to experience the unpleasantness. We'd rather distract ourselves with something pleasant. This is aversion, right? One of the kalesas. This aversion can take different forms, including fear and denial. So, like, we're afraid to see suffering because it makes us realize that at some level, oh, that could happen to me or to my loved ones. So we're afraid. Or we just deny it completely. Oh, no. They're not suffering. That just isn't happening. It's not true. Or that the person who's suffering is suffering because it's their fault. You know, they did something and now they're suffering because they deserve it, right? This is a sad thing I encounter, especially in what I'll call the counterculture world that I suppose I'm part of, having been a hippie in my early days and still having some of that tendency. It's like, you know, there's this whole thing, well, if something's happening, it's because you caused it to happen. You know, if you have cancer, something you did made that cancer happen. And the truth is, stuff is just totally random. Life is totally random. Things just happen. And yes, it may be that, you know, I smoked 30, you know, two packs a day for 30 years. What a surprise, I got lung cancer. There is that as well. And we have to acknowledge that we can, you know, create causes and conditions such that unpleasant things might arise. But most of what happens to people just happens. It's not like someone's arranging it so that they can learn something. You know, it's not God punishing you for doing something. It just happens. That's the nature of reality. I want to read a little bit from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. And he's talking about how can we counteract these habitual patterns I was just talking about? How can we be skillful? And usually when we talk about the Brahma Viharas, we think of them as some sort of like separate practices from mindfulness. But actually mindfulness is critical to experiencing compassion. And that's what Joseph wants to talk about here. Compassion arises out of our willingness to come close to suffering. The problem is that even though we want to be compassionate, and often perhaps are, it's not always easy to open to the suffering that is present. And just as there are many times when we don't want to acknowledge and open to our own pain, we don't necessarily want to be with the pain of others. There are strong tendencies in the mind to keep us defended, withdrawn, and indifferent, or apathetic in the face of suffering. This indifference is often unacknowledged and is the greatest barrier to compassionate experience. Indifference is called the near enemy of equanimity. Now, equanimity being the thing that keeps us in balance when we encounter suffering. But indifference is like, I don't care. It's like it has that sort of equanimous veneer, but it has no heart. It's just, I don't care. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want this. As an experiment, watch your mind the next time you approach a situation of suffering. It might be some pain in the body or some emotional distress like discontent, fear, unworthiness, jealousy, or loneliness. It might be an interaction with a difficult person or a situation of suffering in the world, situations of racial justice, injustice, political or religious violence, or of natural disasters. What happens as we face these situations, either in person or through the vivid images of the media? Do we feel uneasy? Do we withdraw? Do we numb ourselves? Do we let it in? And to do that, to actually let it in, we first of all have to be mindful enough to see the patterns that were the emotional patterns that arise when we encounter suffering. It's mindfulness that allows us to see, oh, it's that again. Here's me yet again avoiding this. Or here's me denying it. Or here's me blaming the person. Or whatever. You know, all our habitual patterns. If we start being mindful and we see them for what they are, then we can let them go because we know. We start to see, that's not true. We see that clearly, that's just our mind caught in aversion. And we let that go, and then we can, and then there's a chance we can just let in what's actually there, what this person is actually experiencing. If we don't turn away, here's yet another way we can react. If we don't turn away, we often get angry. You know, righteous anger doesn't help. It just inflames the situation. It's like, you know, those people are causing those other people a lot of pain and suffering, and it's horrible, and they shouldn't do that. But, you know, we get caught in that, in the rants about how one group of people is causing another group of people suffering. We get angry. And then we get that righteous anger of, it shouldn't be this way, and I know it isn't right, and you know, blah, blah, blah. You can't help when you yourself are caught in an unwholesome mind state. You're caught in this mind state, unwholesome mind state of anger. How can you help anybody from that place? You know, anger can spur you to action. It is useful in the moment. I'm not saying that anger isn't always, you know, sometimes we see and a grave injustice going on, and it makes us angry, and that's a natural response. But if you then sort of carry that anger and make anger being your, you know, your total response, then you're just compounding the suffering. Instead of helping someone have less suffering, you're just creating more, because you're operating from a place of anger. You have to let the anger go, find compassion, and act from a place of compassion, which is a heart connection. You can't have that heart connection and be angry at the same time. All the Brahma Viharas have what are called near enemies. Compassion, it's interesting, has two. Sort of the double whammy of things. Right? The two are pity and sorrow. So pity and near enemies are things that look like, on the external, look just like compassion, but they aren't. So pity looks like compassion, except you sort of step back, remove yourself from the situation, so you're sort of looking down at that poor person or those poor people. I'm above this, looking down at them. I'm not walking in their shoes. I'm just seeing what's going on, but not connecting at the level of heart again. Pity steps makes me step back. Instead, you're caught in your feeling of your own superiority or your own aren't I lucky or whatever, but you're not connected. And you also get caught sometimes in like, oh, aren't I great to notice how sad that situation is? You can get into sort of, that's what part of what pity does well as well. It creates a sense of superiority. I'm better than those people in some way. At least I'm not suffering like they're suffering. That's what pity can create in our hearts and minds. Sorrow is the opposite. In sorrow, we become overwhelmed. Because it's like I can't take it in, and you. But I'm going to do it because I know I'm supposed to be compassionate, and you expose yourself over and over and over again to it, and you just get to the point where you just fall apart. You can't handle it. And this is because you lack equanimity. Remember, here once again, this is how the Brahma Viharas interrelate. Equanimity gives us the balance to look deeply, to experience deeply, but at the same time, not be overwhelmed. It's like the boundary condition that we can create in the sense of, okay, I know I have to take care of myself as well as let this in. This sort of sorrow energy often arises when it's not an individual situation or a small group, it's like the world. The world's falling apart. There's been a lot of talk among people I know about, climate sorrow. Like, just like the fact that the climate is happening, climate change is happening, and all the horrible things that are happening in the world because of that. And they get to a place where they just like can't function. They're overwhelmed by it. And that means they have no capability to be useful to actually do something about it because they're just overwhelmed. Like it's all they can think about. I had a Facebook friend, actually had to stop looking at her Facebook posts, who after the October 7th thing that happened in Israel, she was very strongly identified with the Jewish world and with Zionism. There's nothing wrong with that. But like every day she'd find horrible things that were happening and post them. And like her whole life was consumed by this need to share this, the horribleness of it all over and over and over again. And she wasn't doing herself any good or anyone else any good by posting these things. She just, that's what she had to do. She was overwhelmed by what had happened to the point where she couldn't function in a more sort of, I won't say normal, but a more balanced way. It was sad to see this in her, because she was a nice person in a lot of ways. Everything, all of the Brahma Viharas also have what's called, the far enemy, which tends to be like the opposite of compassion. What's the far enemy of compassion? Cruelty. It's like, I think they should suffer. It's good that they're suffering. They deserve it. And this is a tricky one because, we have to be careful because we might all sit here and think, oh, but I'm not like that. I'm not cruel. But then we hear that someone who had done some heinous crime, something that shocked us. And then, they're executed because that's the state laws. or they're put into prison and the, put them in a prison and throw away the key sort of vibe. And we go to the place in our minds that, well, they deserve that. That's a cruel thought. No one deserves to be killed for those sorts of things. No one deserves to be put in a place that's like a little tiny cell for the rest of their life. It's just, that's cruelty. And when we think that they deserve that, that's a cruel thought. But it seems so natural because it's sort of embedded in our cultural thinking. It seems like, well, of course, they did deserve it. No one, because what we're saying is they deserve to suffer. Whatever it is, they got what they deserved, right? No, and that's a hard place to deal with, because there's a lot of things that happen in the world that are pretty heinous and shocking, and we get caught up in that sort of thinking without even, because it's so deeply embedded in our culture. It's something we cling to. We cling to these ideas that this is right, that these people should suffer this way. Once again, this is where mindfulness becomes important. You read those things, and I'm not saying you shouldn't read them or be exposed to them, or maybe even have a friend who experiences these things, someone close to you. But we have to be really careful not to get caught in the cruelty energy of they deserve it. They deserve to suffer. One way you can see this on a mindful level is these near and far enemies have distinct bodily sensations. Pity, you feel cut off. You feel like separate. It's like you feel like your body is stepping back, stepping away. Sorrow is always heavy. It's like you feel like you're just weighted down. And cruelty is always hot and tight because it has such a strong anger element to it. The heat of anger and the tightness of, at some level, knowing and something here that isn't right, but I don't know what it is, and it feels righteously justified somehow or other. Another aspect of compassion is that it's often seen as weak. Like, if you're compassionate, you must be weak. You wishy-washy person, right? It's another something else I also want to read from Sharon Salzberg here. Sometimes we think that to develop an open heart, to be truly loving and compassionate, means that we need to be passive, to allow others to abuse us, to smile and let anyone do what they want with us. This is not what is meant by compassion. Quite the contrary. Compassion is not at all weak. It is the strength that arises out of seeing the true nature of suffering in the world. Compassion allows us to bear witness to that suffering, whether it is in ourselves or in others, without fear. It allows us to name injustice without hesitation and to act strongly with all the skill at our disposal. To develop this mind state of compassion is to learn to live, as the Buddha put it, with sympathy for all living beings without exception. Just like metta, all living beings without exception. We have compassion for everyone without exception. It's a tall order. It's also, it's also a favorite topic of Jack Kornfield, so I want to read something from him too. He's talking about more directly in our daily life experience, right? No one says this will be easy. Sitting in meditation is difficult, and acting in meditation is equally difficult. It may take years of practice to learn how to enter the family arena or the political arena and stay connected to our deepest compassion. Staying connected takes a particular and conscious effort. Yet what is sacred and what is true is found here as much as anywhere. So this is your practice in daily life, you know, which I have been putting more and more emphasis on, both in my own personal life practice and in what I've been teaching and how I teach. You know, if what the Buddha said isn't applicable to living in the world, if doing these practices isn't applicable to what's living in the world, why are we bothering? Really? You know, we're just separating ourselves into this safe little space, right? We may be confused initially because our world is complex. When we sit alone, we face only our own suffering. When we act in our families and in the world community, we must also face the suffering that connects us with all of life. Hundreds of millions of our brothers and sisters live in situations of great injustice or great poverty. At times, the injustice and the sorrow of it all seems overwhelming, beyond our capacity to face. Yet somehow, something in us knows that this too is part of our spiritual life, and that we can respond to the suffering as part of our own, which in fact it is. None of us can avoid tyranny, loss, sorrow, or death. We are all interconnected in the destruction or saving of our planet. We must remember that the world's current problems are fundamentally a spiritual crisis created by a limited vision of human beings, a loss of a sense of connection to one another, a loss of community, and most deeply, a loss of connection to our spiritual values. I love this. Because it's so, you know, we keep thinking, oh, I got to find a political solution or some sort of financial way to make this happen. And he said, no. This is a spiritual crisis. The world is in the midst of a huge, long ongoing, centuries long perhaps, a spiritual crisis. Political and economic change have never been sufficient in themselves to alleviate suffering when the underlying causes are not also addressed. The worst problems on this earth, warfare, poverty, ecological destruction, and so forth, are created from greed, hatred, prejudice, delusion, and fear in the human mind. To expand our circle of our practice and to face the sorrow of the world around us, we must face these forces in ourselves. Einstein called us nuclear giants and ethical infants. It's a great lie, huh? Einstein called us nuclear giants and ethical infants. Only when we have found a compassion, a goodness, an understanding that transcends our own greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons, can we bring freedom alive in the world around us. So this is like the problem, in a sense. And what the Buddha has been trying to do is to make people aware that this is not, you know, being caught in a world where, in a personal world, where we're driven by greed, hatred, and delusion, just creates more suffering. Instead of being functioning in the world with a heart, open heart, full of loving kindness that allows compassion to arise when it encounters suffering. Very different model, right? The most difficult thing about compassion, in some senses, is to hold this mind state in relation to perpetrators of the suffering of others. You know, we see someone acting and speaking in ways that is just causing untold amounts of suffering. I won't mention any names, but you know what, this is what's going on in the world over and over and over again these days. in lots of places and lots of different angles of whatever the politics of the time is. And the only way we can do this, the only way we can do this is we have to go look at, we're all human beings, all capable of doing horrible things. It's part of being human, is that capacity is there, it's capable. Even if we don't act out of these things, we experience the terrible mental suffering of one who does, tossed about by lust and anger and fear. We all suffer, just as these people are suffering, driven to act the way they do by their suffering. Anyone who acts that way or speaks that way is deeply, deeply suffering. And we have to acknowledge that and let that in so that we can, despite everything, see them as human beings who are, just like us, suffering. It's hard. This is the hard part, right? But it's where the only way I can find to deal with that and those situations with those people that otherwise I just, growl at in my mind, if nothing else. There is, just like in method, there's, actual practice, compassion practice in the Theravada tradition. Unlike metta, where there's a set of four phrases, and compassion is just one phrase. You can still have, move through the categories and think of different people. But the phrase is simply, may you be free from suffering. It's a really simple wish, may you be free from suffering. Just that. And you just repeat, hold someone in your heart mind and repeat that phrase for them. See if you can feel the truth of that as you say it with someone in mind. And it's interesting. It's an interesting phrase because on one level it's talking about, your friend, your partner, your neighbor, your great aunt Tilda, whatever. Who knows? There you see they're suffering because they have some sort of health problem going on, or they've just lost their job, or their partner just left them. There's all kinds of different ways people suffer, right? And we're saying, can you get past that? Can you be free from suffering? So you're wishing that the actual moments of suffering, the time of suffering in the world, goes away. But on another level, we're also saying, may you become an enlightened being. When the Buddha first became enlightened, he was walking away from the Bodhi tree to go find his friend so he could start teaching. Someone encountered him along the road and he was just like glowing. And they said, who are you? And the Buddha answered, I'm the one who no longer suffers. That was his answer to who he is. I'm the one who no longer suffers. So we're saying, holding in our heart minds that I thought, may you be free from suffering, on an absolute level, what we're saying is, may you reach enlightenment, so then you will no longer suffer. Interesting thought, huh? One read a little bit more from Joseph Goldstein here. And he's talking about, this is a section called Awakening Compassion in Ourselves. So this is talking very directly about the practice again. The question for us, how can our hearts stay open given the magnitude of suffering that exists in the world? Is it even possible to open to it all with compassion, diminishing the subtle cruelty of indifference? The challenge is not a theoretical one. It is not enough to admire from afar the qualities of kindness and compassion as being noble ideas, but somewhat removed from our daily lives. It is not enough to cultivate them only in the solitude of a meditation retreat. Our practice is about the transformation of consciousness that makes compassionate responsiveness the default setting of our lives. Compassion requires both openness and equanimity. It requires learning to let things in without drowning in the difficulties and without being overcome by sorrow. It means learning to simply be with the truth of things as they are. This is the great gift of mindfulness that opens us to compassion. Being with the truth of what is present is what we do every time we open to our own pain or our difficulties. As we practice opening to and coming close to the suffering in our own lives with compassion, we then have greater strength and courage to be with the suffering of others. And that's one of the greatest gifts you can give anyone, is to be with them as they suffer, to be connected at the level of heart with them. Putting it much more simply, this is a book called One Robe, One Bowl, the Zen Poetry of Ryokan. And there's this very simple little bit of poetry called Ryokan Zen, lived in a little hut in the mountains in Japan. Oh, that my priest robes were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. That's our aspiration. That we can. Oh, that my priest's robe were wide enough. In other words, I could take in everything to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world, to hold them all without exception. And then a little bit of Mary Oliver. This is from the poem called Breakage from Why I Wake Early. Describes sort of seeing things as they really are in an interesting metaphorical way. I go down to the edge of the sea, how everything shines in the morning light, the cusp of the whelk, the broken cupboard of the clam, the open blue mussels, moon snails, pale pink and barnacle scarred, and nothing at all whole or shut, but tattered, split, dropped by the gulls onto the gray rocks, and all the moisture gone. It's like a schoolhouse of little words, thousands of words. First you figure out what each one means by itself, the jingle, the periwinkle, the scallop, full of moonlight. Then you begin slowly to read the whole story. We see all the brokenness in the world, and we then slowly start to see the whole story, which is what the Buddha did. So that's what I have to share tonight.